97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
Wiggins America.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
Wiggins America.
The only thing I'm going to need from you guys right now is a cup of coffee.
Wiggins.
Today's global economy waits for no man.
America.
Today's global business climate is like,
whatever, dude.
Hey. Politics is a dirty game. I'm not sure we want to play.
There are forces here at work that you couldn't possibly understand.
You have no idea how high up this goes.
Welcome to Wiggins America.
America was going bankrupt extremely quickly. And nobody seems to, everyone seems to be sort of whistling past the graveyard on this one. You know, the Defense Department budget is a very big budget, okay? It's $1 trillion a year, DOD, Intel, it's $1 trillion. And interest payments on the national debt just exceeded the Defense Department budget. They're over $1 trillion a year, just in interest, and rising. We're adding $1 trillion to the net, to our debt, which our, you know, kids and grandkids are going to have to pay somehow every 3 months, and then soon it's going to be every 2 months, and then every month, and then the only thing we'll be able to pay is interest.
Boys, we got to get this thing under control, don't we? Hey, this is Wiggins America. We've been talking about Musk versus Trump. Pretty much all the time, the last couple days of the week anyway. I think this started on Wednesday, and I just so happened to be coming back from vacation on Wednesday. And then I hosted the Annie Fry Show both Thursday and Friday, and will again on Monday and Tuesday. This might still be the big story by then. I think they're starting to kind of ease up. This is just the weirdest thing. Like, personally speaking, these two personalities are just mega huge ego personalities. They think they can conquer the world and basically have. And to see them fight is just, it's political drama. I mean, it's just drama. It's really, really remarkable to see this, and it's something that is very much breaking through to the entire world. There are reports that Vladimir Putin said that he would negotiate a peace treaty between them. I haven't confirmed that that's true, but that joke is going around, and it might actually be true, because it would be a funny joke. But the personal stuff aside, I really like the debate that they're having. And I'm really actually pretty glad that Elon Musk has taken up this mantle. You know, Thomas Massey and Rand Paul have been yelling this for a long time. But you need somebody to yell from the rooftops, you have to balance the budget. Stop spending more than we're sending you, because you're going to bankrupt the country. We've been yelling that for so long that it kind of loses all meaning, but we're really there. You know, I played that clip of Musk there. Now, that's before the spat began, of him talking about how important it is that we stop overspending. You know, I would like to get to the point where the U.S. government actually has a surplus coming in, not because I want to pay them more, but because we have to value the currency that we all use if we want to maintain power and wealth and our way of life at all. We have to do this. But I'm also willing to, my concession would be that as long as we balance the budget, then the growth surplus could possibly grow us out of debt. And I'd be okay with that, but you'd have to stick to it. And the minute Democrats get in there, you know, they're just going to spend again. So you got to give a little bit. And that, to me, is where the give should be. But the conversation among conservatives, remember, we're conservative fiscally, should be, how do we balance the budget? Not just how do we pass this domestic agenda, which is Trump's agenda. And really, I've been through this, and I'm not going to do it again here just for sake of time, but Trump's agenda that's going to pass through the big, beautiful bill, should it pass, is really good. There are very few items in there, a few that I'm kind of neutral on, but for the most part, it's really good stuff. But you can't spend more to do it than we're bringing in. Otherwise, you're going to ruin the country. you're going to ruin the country. And this is why I'm very glad that Elon Musk has thrown down the gauntlet and said, I will not move from this spot. You shall not pass. And the Thomas Massey's of the world have said, finally, somebody's moving the Overton window back to that discussion, because this should be where conservatives land. This should be from where we start talking, not that we're trying to fight to get there. A lot of practical reasons why this might be tough, of course, but where do you fall on this? We've done poll after poll on the Andy Frey Show about, do you fall with Trump here? Do you want to pass his agenda because that's too important? Or are you with Musk that we've got to balance the budget? I'm kind of with Musk here. I'm going to tell you the truth, that as much as I want to pass all the stuff in the big, beautiful bill that I really do like, you just have to balance it, and you have to do it now. Apparently, Elon and Mike Johnson had a decent conversation. Mike Johnson was trying to get a hold of him all day Thursday and say, hey, let's talk. And he wasn't talking. And then finally Thursday night, he answered the phone. They had a conversation. And in Johnson's words, that eased Musk's mind a little bit. And that eases my mind a little bit, because that says that, you know, if you do pass this thing as is, which I still am not for, but even if you don't quite balance the budget, he's saying they have a plan to balance the budget after they do this. The problem is, how many times have you heard that? We've heard that a lot from Congress, and it never happens. So we've got to see some action there, and that's why I think that we do have to do this now. Otherwise, it will never happen. That's what's at stake here. If you don't balance the budget now, you literally will never balance the budget outside of some weird black swan event that nobody could predict. But usually black swan events look like COVID, where you spend $10 trillion extra dollars into the deficit and you don't regain that. But I'm just allowing there to be a 0.01% chance that, hey, maybe something weird happens and we find that they're building underground cities for $10 trillion a year, and we don't know about it. And the minute you cut that off, you balance the budget. You know, something crazy. Anyway, we are going to take a short break here, because we do have a pretty full show. Now, some of the interviews that I've got here are interviews with Hans von Spakovsky, for instance, and some near-death experience stuff that I really enjoy. And some of that is from Annie's show. And we're going to do that here in Wiggins America. But we are going to revisit this topic of Musk versus Trump, more specifically in the ways that this bill should be changed, because I think we should talk specifics, although it's really hard, because this is why you have representatives. Because if I just go and read the bill, half of the stuff, I don't even know what it is. So I can't just go, oh, look, here's a spending bill for condors in Finland. We should cut that, you know, because that stuff's already been cut. This is the big stuff, the entitlement programs that need genuine reform, that you can't just say, oh, let's cut that. You have to change it. And that's tough, and that's why you have representatives in Congress. Anyway, we'll get to that. We'll get to Hans von Spakovsky on national injunctions next.
Wiggins America.
And then you can respond to what the attorney for the family said. Punishing individuals, including children as young as 4 years old, for the purported actions of their relatives is a feature of medieval justice systems or police state dictatorships, not democracies.
Is this family in the country legally or not?
Actually, I'm not sure.
I think they may not
be.
And obviously in the household, you have extreme radicalism, and that has now led to the literal burning of American citizens on the streets of this country in a clear act of domestic terrorism. And so, again, we have an individual district court judge stepping in here to try to prevent the commander-in-chief of the United States from protecting Americans from a clear invasion of radicalism.
That's, of course, Scott Jennings on CNN making some wise points that otherwise wouldn't be on CNN. This is Ryan Wiggins filling in for Annie Fry. Love to get to talk to Hans von Spakovsky.
We, the people of the United States,
more perfect.
In our form of our perfect union.
Heritage legal expert Hans von Spakovsky.
Hans, I just got back from vacation, but I did see this story, and I was catching up this morning. A judge has blocked the deportation of this family of the suspect from being deported, even though they're here illegally. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, which I don't understand at all, because the father, the terrorist, overstayed his visa. And when you overstay your visa under federal immigration law, you are immediately deportable. And if he overstayed his visa, it means his family did the same, assuming they even had permission to be in that country. So this is, once again, a federal district court judge acting outside of the law.
Hans, what is even the judge's rationale here? Because that seems pretty open and shut to me.
I don't know what the judge's rationale
is. Okay, good.
I mean, and that's the case in so many of these injunctions. I'll give you another example of this where there is no rationale. Recently, the Supreme Court issued an emergency stay stopping and suspending an injunction who'd been issued by a lower court judge over the fact that the administration had ended the mass parole they granted to illegal aliens from a number of countries, Nicaragua, Venezuela, Cuba, 500,000. And what was the reason given by the judge? Well, it wouldn't be in the public interest to do that. Well, the public interest? That's what Congress decides, not you, judge. You're supposed to enforce the law. But that tells you just how out of control these judges are.
Well, yeah, and if you use public interest, you could just make up whatever you want and say, I feel as if that would be against what I think would be good. So what that sounds like. Not me, of course, not a legal expert, but I'm looking at this case and going, okay, the idea of process and due process seems to be coming up over and over. And I may have asked you this before when I was in here with Annie in the last couple months, but do illegal immigrants have the right to due process in the same way an American citizen does?
No, the answer is no. And here's what confuses people, particularly people on the left. Immigration proceedings are not criminal proceedings. They're civil proceedings. And the reason that's important is this. Look, if you're being criminally prosecuted, you know, for burglary, rape, assault, whatever, yeah, you're entitled to the constitutional due process rights. It doesn't matter whether you're a citizen or you're an alien, whether you're here legally or illegally. But an immigration proceeding, an action by the government to remove you from the country, is a civil proceeding, not a criminal proceeding. And so therefore, you know, everybody knows this from watching TV, right? What do the cops have to do when they arrest you? They have to read you your Miranda rights, right?
Right.
You have the right to remain silent. You have a right to a lawyer. The government doesn't have to do that when they arrest and detain an illegal alien. No Miranda rights apply. Not only that, but the government doesn't have to furnish you with a lawyer. Why? Because it's a civil proceeding, and particularly for aliens, your due process rights, yeah, you have some, but they are not coextensive with what American citizens get.
You know, Stephen Miller said this a few weeks ago, and I actually printed it out from Twitter because I thought it was such a good quote. I wish I had in front of me right now, because you're talking kind of brought it to mind. That the number of district court judges and federal judges, I'm going to get it wrong, but it was something like 400 to 600 people basically are acting as president right now, because they issue orders on things that the elected president has done that we've never really seen this happen before in American history, at least not to this extent.
No, that is exactly right. There wasn't even a nationwide injunction ever issued in our history until 1963. And until the first Trump presidency, the number was very small. We're now at the point where I think something like three quarters of the total number of nationwide injunctions ever issued in U.S. history have all been issued against who? The Trump administration.
That's amazing. That is amazing. So in 1963, now you've got me curious, Hans. Hans von Spakovsky with a senior legal fellow, Heritage Foundation. Now you got me curious. In 1963, had that always existed constitutionally and somebody just finally used it, or they kind of make that up?
No, they made it up. They made it up. The rules are very strict about this, and hopefully the Supreme Court will finally step in and stop this. Now, the one thing I do have to say is, look, this is really frustrating. But on the other hand, what people are overlooking is that the Trump administration actually has won some pretty significant victories at the Supreme Court already, because what's happening with almost every one of these cases is they're filing emergency appeals of these injunctions to the Supreme Court. And in I've counted almost a dozen cases where the Supreme Court has stepped in, issued a stay, and allowed what they were doing to go forward. I mean, like what I was just talking about, when a lower court judge said, oh, you can't revoke the mass parole of 500,000 illegal aliens in the country, the Supreme Court stepped in and said, yes, you can.
Hans, is the Supreme Court playing it safe right now? Are they going to have to address this issue head on, and they're just reluctant to do so? And are they going to do that soon? Are they going to have to do that soon?
Well, I think they're going to have to do it soon. And the reason is that on May 15th, you know, they heard oral arguments in a case involving the birthright citizenship issue. But the issue before the court were the nationwide injunctions issued by three different judges in three different states. And they weren't talking, they weren't arguing about the substantive merits. In other words, is Trump correct in his interpretation of the citizenship clause? They were talking about the appropriateness of a nationwide injunction. So we're going to get a decision. You know, what's today, June 5th? The Supreme Court term ends on June 30th. So we're going to get a decision from them between now and June 30th on nationwide injunctions in this particular case, birthright citizenship. And I suspect they're going to lay out prominently rules that are going to affect all these other cases. At least I hope they do.
Hans, before we run out of time with you, because you keep saying things that I'm like, oh, I wanted to ask you about that, too. with Trump and all these nationwide injunctions, nobody can argue, if you're paying attention at all, that the courts are actively, you know, you can say weaponizing themselves against the elected president of the United States right now. But the left would say, well, it's because Trump is so out of line. You know, he's doing things that are that the courts have to stop because they're so illegal. I just wondered if you could address that.
That is just simply not true. And again, I give you another example of what we're talking about, the fact that, you know, the president has the power to give illegal aliens what's called temporary protected status, which makes them legal for a short amount of time. And what the statute says is TPS can be extended to people who are from a country where some emergency has happened. And the best example of that is, remember some years ago when the huge hurricane hit Haiti, the president gave temporary protected status to Haitians who came to the U.S. That is totally within the prerogative of the president to grant that, which means it's totally within the prerogative of a president to end it. And yet when the president ended temporary protected status of Venezuelan nationals that the Biden administration had granted, you had a lower court saying, oh, no, you can't do that. How can it be within the discretion of a president to grant it, but it's not within the discretion of the president to end it? The statute makes it very clear it is. And yet you had this judge ruling against the president. It's the judges who are acting illegally, not President Trump.
Mm. Well, hopefully the Supreme Court can get this right, and we'll continue to talk to you about it, because I'm going to give you a suggestion, Hans. Don't go on vacation ever. because if you do, catching up in the Trump era is really tough when you come back because so much happens in a week.
All right, I'll tell my wife that I can't go on a vacation this summer.
You can tell her I said so.
I will do that.
Yesterday, at this time, I shared a couple stories about celebrities who died. And I said then, it's not really about the fact that they're celebrities. There's a lot of stories out there about people who died and came back and what they saw and stuff. And I think they're all pretty interesting. But when it's a celebrity like Jeremy Renner, you know, kind of like Phil Robertson, like these people are at the top of their profession. They're worldwide famous. They don't really need money. they have nothing to gain from telling these stories, which is why I find them more interesting. That when he had that injury with... it was like a massive tractor or something that rolled over him, almost killed him. In fact, he says did kill him. He told the near-death experience story, and I told that yesterday. And then I told one about Jamie Foxx, too, and Jamie Foxx's was actually very negative. He started going down a dark tunnel. Did you hear this? We were talking about it yesterday. You weren't in the room.
No, I did not hear this.
Jamie Foxx started going down. He collapsed in 2023. It was like both Jeremy Renner and Jamie Foxx were in similar situations. Different injuries, different causes of death. But they both had stuff happen, and everybody knew something had happened to them, but nobody really knew what.
Right.
Jamie Foxx, similarly, something happened. It just medical complications, they said. And he passed out and then got taken to a hospital where his sister was praying for him outside the room. Well, he said in the hospital room, he started going down a tunnel and he felt like he was like, and his words, which were very salty, he's like, I'm not going down this blanking tunnel because it was hot. And he's like, I'm going to the wrong blanking place. In his words, that's what he said. But his sister was who had brought him to the hospital, was outside the room, like, on the floor praying for him, and he said he got brought back.
What the heck?
And that's as far as he tells the story. He didn't tell much else than that.
Jamie Foxx. Wow.
He said
that's
it was
crazy.
He said the tunnel for him was hot, and he started to freak out because he goes, this isn't where I want to go.
Yeah.
And at the end, he could see like something like beckoning him, and he did not want to go there.
Whoa. That's pretty crazy.
Right? So get the podcast, Ethan.
Nice.
You can listen to it yesterday.
Dang it.
But I found this article with all these different celebrity stories. Some of them are... here's a little background for you. I'll tell you a story. I used to do a TV show based on this topic. I don't know if you knew that. It was called What It's Like to Die. You could probably still find it out there somewhere. It's buried in the algorithm on YouTube, probably at this point. But you could find it if you search my name, What It's Like to Die. The TV show, I shot probably 4 episodes of it total. This would have been 2012 through 2015-ish, around there. The show never got picked up, though, so I only ended up finishing like 1 or 2 of the episodes, and then I have all this footage still that I never did anything with. Well, over the span of doing that show, I met hundreds of people, and I'd have to seek them out, and met hundreds of people who'd have death experiences, and I was looking for commonality. I was looking for, really, because it's TV too, I was looking for interesting stories and people who could tell those stories well. And the more background I could find on verifying their stories, the better. But ultimately, I found, you know, of these hundreds of people, 90% of them, they would have very genuine stories. I'm not saying they weren't real, but they were quick. They were very fast stories, like usually a hospital room, but sometimes somewhere else. I felt myself leaving my body and looking down on myself, and I realized something about life or death, and then I went back in my body. Like, that's the nature of most of the stories that I would find. Doesn't mean that I didn't believe them. They were just such quick stories, and there were so many of them that were similar that I was like, I can't really do a lot with that for TV. In fact, one of them, I hope I'm not like sharing anything I shouldn't hear. One of the guys was from New Haven, Missouri, and he was a race car driver. And I don't know like the different types. I think it was more of like a NASCAR stock car.
Okay.
But I'm not very good at qualifying that.
Sure.
But he, as far as I know, still lives in New Haven and could be listening right now. Don't even know. And he died while racing. And I don't know where it was, but the thing I remember about it is that they had footage of his death because he was in a race. And so they were recording it because it's a race, even if it wasn't a huge one. And I'm like, dude, you have video recording of the moment this happened to you? And he's like, yeah, I got the wreck. You know, we got the wreck. And I'm like, well, shoot, for TV, that's pretty good, you know? So I kind of followed up with him. But even his story was one where he went up. He went way up above, out of his body, according to him, above the racetrack. And the crazy thing is he said, I was looking down on people scrambling to help me and to clean up the wreckage of my car, and because it was a bad wreck, obviously he was dead. But the other thing that was interesting is he said he was looking out into the parking lot of this racetrack, and he could see all these different cars and things going on far away. That when he came back, he was able to report on and say, "Oh, look, I saw these. I can tell you how I know is because I saw this stuff in the parking lot out there." And they really kind of verify, like, "Yeah, there's no way you would have been able to see that other than being up that high or in the parking lot," which you clearly were not in the parking lot. We knew where you were.
Yeah.
So just cool stories like that. But the ones that I was looking for the most were ones where they went a little further.
Right.
You know, they saw heaven or hell or something more than just I left and I came back quick, right? Because, you know, tell a story. It's a TV show. In the midst of doing that, I met a lot. I shouldn't say a lot. I met some kooks. I met some people whose stories were a little goofy and I wasn't sure really what to do with them. And the more I tried to verify those stories, the more I ran into brick walls. And here's the crazy thing. One of those guys who he had an amazing story. I had him come to a church that I was at once because I thought, gosh, this is an amazing story. I couldn't quite, it's a death story. You can't verify it. You know, you can't get the facts and be like, well, I think the part about the tunnel's right, but the part about heaven, I don't know. You can't verify it. So you have to verify as much around it as you can. Well, I hadn't quite gotten to that point with him when he came to guest speak at a church that I had been attending. And here's what's wild. This was in Pontoon Beach, Illinois. He speaks, he gives his testimony, he gives his story. Well, this wasn't a huge church. It wasn't a small church, but it wasn't a huge church. And this was like a Sunday night, you know, an extra service. We didn't publicize it. The guy's name wouldn't have meant anything. We said, oh, you know, Joe is coming. Nobody's going to be like, oh, wow, I'm going to go see Joe. You know, nobody knew who he was. So he comes and speaks. He gives his story about how he died and he went to heaven and all this. And it's a very, very fascinating story. Well, because we hadn't publicized it, this was really before social media, too. It's like 20 years ago. No, we didn't expect any guests to be showing up at church on a Sunday night to see him specifically. But a dad and a son showed up. And we were all like, oh, okay, you know, it's a church, so great. Love it when new people come. But we didn't expect anybody to come. So they sit down. Nobody's ever seen these two guys before. It's a dad and a son, probably a 10-year-old kid. And they sat down. Nobody thought anything of it. You know, everybody's just there to hear the guy speak. So he starts speaking and starts telling his story. In the middle of this guy speaking, that dad stands up in the church service and yells, "You're not glorifying God. You're glorifying yourself." And then everybody stops and turns and is like, who is that guy? Nobody's seen this guy before. And then people are like, this guy's belligerent. So they try to get him out of there. Mm-hmm. And he leaves with no, he left easily. Like him and his son, they just left.
Sure.
And I was like, what in the world just happened? And the guy speaking, you know, old Joe or whatever, he's like, you know, it stirs up the spirits whenever you talk about this stuff. And I was like, man, I don't know what to make of that. Well, later I found that old Joe was a crackpot. And his story did not make any sense. He would tell it multiple different ways.
Oh, no.
So I had acted prematurely in inviting him to speak. And I learned my lesson. Like, I was pretty young when I was doing this. But I learned my lesson and found out, oh, man, like, old Joe isn't his name, but that's what I'm calling him.
Sure.
This guy was totally illegit. And then I always thought back to who was the random guy that walked in that nobody knew who stood up and yelled
this guy is a fraud.
Right.
Like, what? So I never have known what to make of that story. I've never told it before, but there you go.
That's so weird.
There's a little background on why I'm interested all these stories. So they give one on Al Pacino here. Al Pacino says that he died. It's one of those where it goes up, comes down.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that's not interesting, but here's the one that I was like, ooh, I'm going to tell this one. Nikki Six. You know who Nikki Six is?
Mm-mm.
Motley Crue.
Okay.
In the 1980s, Motley Crue was notorious for their drug usage, and it almost spelled the end for co-founder Nikki Six, as he wrote in a 2017 op-ed for the Los Angeles Times. Heroin nearly killed me. As a matter of fact, it did. For 2 minutes in 1987, I was pronounced clinically dead from an overdose. On December 23rd, 1987, after a drug-fueled evening of partying with fellow rock stars from Rat and Guns N' Roses, man, talk about a time period.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's like a time capsule. Six was shooting up between snorts of cocaine and shots of booze when he was injected with one last dose of heroin and promptly passed out. However, this overdose wasn't like previous ones. Six estimates that he has overdosed about a half a dozen times.
Jeez.
Because the now 66-year-old, turned blue. In his memoir, The Heroin Diaries, A Year in the Life of the Shattered Rockstar, he stated that Slash's then-girlfriend Sally McLaughlin desperately tried to perform mouth-to-mouth resuscitation because she thought, uh-oh, he's dead. Before an ambulance could arrive, Nikki Six had an out-of-body experience. He recalled, I tried to sit up to figure out what was going on because everybody around him was kind of panicking. I thought it would be really hard to lift my body, but to my surprise, I shot upright as if I weighed nothing. Then it felt as if something very gentle was grabbing my head and pulling me upward. Above me, everything was bright white. I looked down and realized I had left my body. Nikki Six, or the filthy tattooed container that had once held him, this is him speaking, was lying covered face to toe with a sheet on a gurney being pushed by medics into an ambulance. He's looking down on himself. Once paramedics were on the scene, they revived Nikki Six with two shots of adrenaline into his heart and rushed him to the hospital, which he wasn't pleased about. Six remembers waking up and saying, quote, there was a cop asking me questions, so I told him to go blank himself. I ripped out my tubes and staggered in just my leather pants into the parking lot where two teenage girls were sitting crying out around a candle. They were fans. They had heard on the radio that I was dead and looked kind of surprised to see me.
I can imagine.
Amidst the chaos, word had gotten out that Six had, in fact, died, and news stations started reporting it. However, after the teens got over their initial shock, they gave Nikki Six a ride, a jacket, and a lecture about quitting drugs. The incident inspired Motley Crue's 1989 hit, Kickstart My Heart.
No way.
Kid
what the
you
heck?
Not. Kid you not. Now, if you want a little bit deeper out of body. Now, that one's like, okay, went out of body, came back real mm-hmm. quick, right? But the story is just interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Tracy Morgan. How about this one?
Yeah, okay.
So did you know that he had some health issues too?
I just knew about he was the one that got in the major car accident,
he got,
right?
Yes. Yes. I should say health issues. Yeah. He had a.
That's what you were referring
that's
to.
That's what I'm referring
okay,
to.
Yes.
That's what I'm referring to. On June 7th, 2014, a Walmart truck collided with the back of a 10-seat limousine carrying Tracy Morgan and four other passengers on the New Jersey Turnpike. Morgan's friend and mentor, comedian James McNair, known as Uncle Jimmy Mack, was killed in the crash, while Morgan and the other three passengers suffered severe injuries. In his 2017 special, Staying Alive, the 30 Rock star stated, I suffered some terrible injuries, traumatic brain injury. I broke every bone in my face, my ribs. I pulverized my femur. I'm from the ghetto, and after I came out of the coma, I was blind for a week. I'm not sure why I'm from the ghetto there, but he does. Morgan was in a coma for 2 weeks and claims that during that time, he saw a glimpse of the afterlife. Quote, I went to the other side. This is not something I'm making up. Do you know what God said to me? He said, your room ain't ready. I still got something to do for you. And here I am doing an interview with you.
That's insane.
After the comedian awoke, he was in a wheelchair for 5 months and went into rehab to relearn how to both walk and speak. A year later, he made a triumphant return to SNL as host. I actually remember some of this.
Mm-hmm.
You knew that he was in a bad accident, but a lot of times when these things happen to big celebrities, the PR team kind of takes over and locks everything down because they want to filter out information very carefully.
Right.
Because they're thinking long term, like, well, if they come back like he did, we want to make sure that this doesn't become the defining characteristic of this person, that you sure. only think about that and that kills their career or something like that, which I totally understand. But in a 2020 interview with Oprah Winfrey for Super Soul Sunday, the now 56-year-old Tracy Morgan explained that he'll never be normal again, but a few of the changes in his life have been for the better. Quote, I told my wife that the other day something's different. The way I am with people, something's just different. I find myself saying I love you 200 times a day to strangers. I don't care. I don't got to know you to love you. I love you. He continued, that's how we're supposed to be as human beings. We're supposed to take care of each other. What we see sometimes down here on earth, ain't no room for that up in heaven. Ain't no room for it. I thought that was cool.
Yeah.
So there's a few more of those. We'll see if I can filter them in over the next couple days. We're not going to do any more today, but I will tell you that there's, you know, some names that you'd know in here. Burt Reynolds is one of them.
Wow.
I thought some of those were the better stories.
Just to say real quick, it's cool how, you know, it's almost like in these situations, it's like, don't waste it. Don't waste the gift that's been given to you. And, you know, it's refreshing to, you know, hear and see people to this caliber of celebrity, like, get hit deep with that and understand that and implement that. So that's cool to hear the response as to, you know, how they go following the trauma they experience.
Yeah, I like hearing the way that it changed them here,
mm-hmm.
which a lot of these don't tell. I mean, these are pretty quick hit little bullet point things. But Tracy Morgan's been really open about that. I've actually read, he's one of the only ones in this whole packet. It's a very thick packet of different people. Be surprised at how many different celebrities have had these things happen and don't talk about them for a long, long time. And then, you know, toward the end of their life, they might write a memoir, like Elizabeth Taylor is one of them. Weird. I have very little time here, but here's the real point between Musk and Trump and really what we should be talking about, the issue instead of the personalities, which is the U.S. federal debt. The deficit and the debt are different things. They're linked. The deficit is how much we are short and how much we're adding to the national debt every year. That's the deficit. The national debt is the overall amount that the country owes to its creditors. And that right now is about $36, $37 trillion, roughly. But here's a quick history of it. In 1945, it shoots up. It had almost been nothing up until 43, during the World War II, it shoots up to about $5 trillion. Then it goes back down when the war is over to about $3 trillion. Still not good. But then, for whatever reason, from about 1945 or 6 through 1984, that's a long period of time, it stays at $3 trillion. Then, during the Reagan administration through George W. Bush, basically, it goes up from $3 or $4 trillion to about $10 trillion in 2004. During the second half of Bush's tenure, it goes up to about, it goes from $10 trillion to about $13 trillion, and then immediately spikes when Obama takes his office up to about, like, he added about $10 trillion real quick, and then it's just been going up ever since. That's how quickly we've added most of our national debt. It's so recent that we're really catching up with the ramifications of it. And it has to be dealt with now because the rate at which it's exploding, our national debt, we will never stop it if we don't stop it now. All right, that's the end of the show. You can get the whole podcast typing in Wiggins America, and I encourage you to do so. Thanks for listening.
Get more at 971talk.com.